Coronavirus pandemic update and report with virologist Dr. Henry Nyman, Ph.D. His website is recombinomics.com. Okay. A.G. Barr, Attorney General Bill Barr, is now threatening to sue states which are keeping its citizens under house arrest. Barr also is threatening to sue states that don't open up when Trump says they should open up. And then we have the summary of the latest fact checks. Latest false claims from Donald Trump, iterated today in the Tuesday news briefing. Let's see what CNN says here. President Donald Trump uttered fewer false claims than usual at the White House Corona briefing on Tuesday, but he did make at least a couple, and he made other statements that were missing key context. Here are some fact checks, and it goes on from there. Anyhow, some of these are really legendary. The way, if you read the actual verbatim transcripts of how he speaks and what he says, it's bizarre. It's like the reverse. No, it's not the reverse. It's like Joe Biden, but he's not demented. He's just fragmented. I guess there's a difference there somewhere. Anyhow, let's say hello to Henry Nyman. Welcome back. And, yeah, things are moving right along. We're getting closer to 60,000 every day.
Yeah, the numbers are going up pretty dramatically. And they're actually starting to accelerate. That's why the situation as far as the lockdown and future activities are all looking pretty dire, and it's a situation that's not going to end well. It's going to end very poorly, and I don't know. The increases, I mean, there's a lot of misinformation now that's coming out at the White House briefings, even on the science side. It's not really very credible. You know, I've been tracking each of the states and what they've been putting up, and seeing how the deaths and the individual cases, you know, each daily numbers. And it looks like the virus has got a strong foothold. I thought it was going to start declining now for a seasonal reason, but right. It actually seems to be increasing in most of the rural areas and the areas that had lower numbers previously. And it does seem to have definitely flattened in New York, and it does actually look like it's starting to decline in New York. And maybe a few of the other big cities have already got to the plateau and are starting to come down. But there's enough other ones that are newer that haven't flattened yet. And they're not going up in the exponential phase where they're doubling every two or three days, which was happening, you know, 3 or 4 weeks ago. But they are still going up pretty steadily, and the number of cases is getting higher, and so you know, even if they go up incrementally, that's still a pretty big number, and they kind of make up for the decline in New York. And as a result, they today I think was the highest number of new cases on record. It's got to be pretty close. It was almost 33,000, and the New York.
These are single confirmed with a test. Single confirmed.
Right. These are the 50 states reporting new cases. So you take the cases they reported today and subtract the ones that they had. You know, the total today minus the total yesterday are the number of new cases. And you know, to give you an idea, Pennsylvania, like I said, I think today's might be a little bit left over from yesterday's. I mean, yesterday would have been Sunday's results, and I was saying it looked a little bit on the low side. And it could be that some areas didn't report fully yesterday on Sunday's results, and they made up for it today. And so today was supposed to be Monday's results, but you know, if they got a little bit of Sunday's thrown in, that might be why it got as high as it did today. But Pennsylvania was striking. They had 360 new cases, which is far and above their highest. I think the highest they had was 280 or so, which was a couple of days ago, and that was, you know, very, very high. So they reported 360 today. New Jersey reported 376. Massachusetts reported 150. Michigan reported 242. And so these are all, and these are just deaths. You know, deaths just for the one day. So once they start getting that to 100 or so, you know, that gets to be fairly significant. So there were over 2,500 deaths today, of which less than 500 came from New York. So, you know, over 2,000 deaths came from the rest of the country today, which is a lot for one day. And that's why, you know, as you said, there, probably going to hit, we'll almost definitely now hit 60,000 deaths by the end of this month. I mean, the projection for the 60,000 was actually for this summer. It was supposed to get up to 60,000 this summer, and that was reduced from the 100 to 200,000 that they had projected with good social distancing. They could keep to that. Without that, it would have gone to 1 and 2 million deaths. So when it was lowered to 60,000, I think one time Trump said, oh, 60,000 looks like that might be what they end up at. And then lately he's been saying 50 to 60,000. Not going to be able to say 50 to 60,000 because in a couple of days it'll already be at 50,000. So,
well, reality's never stood in his way before. So.
Well, that's what the problem is. And that's why I see this not being a good outcome because, he basically wants to have it both ways. He wants to say, you know, it could be A, could be yes, could be no. And maybe it could be maybe. That's what he says about a lot of things.
Yes,
and
he does.
On this one, he's going and taking credit for the shutdown, essentially saying, you know, if we did nothing, there'd have been 1 to 2 million, and now we've got the, you know, we've flattened the curve, and it's and now they're talking 100 or 200,000, and he thinks he can do better than that. And then lately he's been talking about, you know, 50 to 60,000. How much better that is to, than 100 or 200,000 or 1 to 2 million. And Pence is, you know, thanking the American people for doing this and getting this under control. And then he does, you know, his, liberation kind of tweets on, free states, which, none of which are anywhere near, the levels that were suggested to go into the stage one to start loosening things up. I mean, he did Virginia, Michigan, and Minnesota. And the only thing those three states have in common is they're, they've got Democratic governors and they're, kind of borderline as far as the election is concerned. So they're blue states that, that could turn red. And so he's basically asking for them to be liberated, even though none of them, are anywhere near the requirements. I mean, the requirements for easing up, restrictions are the cases go down, for a, 2 week period and, with significant testing. And the numbers aren't going down for any of the, any of those three states. In fact, Michigan is one of the highest states in the country with, mostly in the Detroit area. So his, tweets are basically go against what his policy is, which is to go and get the, flatten the curve and, don't let up until you meet these requirements. And, that's and right. He even talks, and even in his talk, oh, there's 20 states that have, that are getting ready to open up because they've met these requirements, which I think is a generous interpretation. I don't think there's anything near 20 states. But in any event, Virginia, Michigan, and Minnesota are not among those 20. And so, yeah, he gets questions. What about all these demonstrations? And, I mean, they did it in Pennsylvania today or yesterday. And like I said, today there were 360 deaths in Pennsylvania, which is a very, very high number in their, you know, Pennsylvania moved up to fourth place in the country. They're
number four now.
33,000 cases. So, no, actually, it's 33 yesterday. It's 34,000 cases. So they got 34,000 cases, and they jumped up to 1,500 deaths. And yesterday, 1,564. Yesterday, they were 1,504. I mean, they literally went up from 1,200 to 1,500 in one day. So it's definitely not really in the under control category. And the reporters say, well, you got these demonstrators and they're not really wearing masks and they're not really social distancing and they're kind of packed together in these demonstrations and they're just going to, you know, affect each other and take it home to their children, and they're just going to make matters worse. And he says, I didn't see much, many problems. It looks to me like they were spread out. Yeah, you know, there's all these pictures.
I saw a story today that a number of these protesters now, I don't know how big a number, some are already reporting symptoms. They're not feeling real good. So we'll see. I want to also point, if I might, to a story that's up right near the top of headlines. It's entitled Warning from a New York City Man Who Lost Both His Parents to Coronavirus in a Matter of Just a Few Days. And he wrote to me, and I thought it was very worthy of all of you seeing, to understand what it's like to be in the middle of this thing in New York, for example, and then to have lost both of your parents. It's quite a vivid portrait of a very unpleasant situation. And as Henry is saying, this is going to open up quite clearly. Trump is rolling the dice. People are going to get infected. It doesn't look so far like there's going to be much of a seasonal dip, at least at this point in time. Remember, the seasonal aspect is not temperature. It's not 105 degrees outside and the virus is all going to die. It's ultraviolet light, so people have to get out in it to essentially allow the virus to be killed. Otherwise, it's going to stay indoors with them. So we're on the doorstep of, unfortunately, a very unsuccessful move by Mr. Trump. At least that's the way it looks to me.
Well, there's all these packets that of high concentration. There's the nursing homes, and so the virus is there, and it's going through the staff, and the staff take it to other nursing homes, and the staff takes it to their families, and so it's got kind of a reservoir there. And the same thing's happening with prisons now, where, you know, there's literally hundreds or thousands in a given prison. And it's the same thing where you've got the staff at the prison are going to get infected and they're going to take it home to their families. And then you've got these meat processing plants, and the numbers keep on going up. It's throughout the Midwest primarily. And, it goes from one plant to the other, and sometimes it's the same company that's got multiple plants in multiple states that are, even though they're in different states, they're really not that far apart. And they can have, family members that, you know, go to one plant and other family members go to another plant, and they can, you know, connect the plants that way and, move it from one to the other. And their working conditions aren't great. And the companies don't seem to be that responsive, and they kind of acknowledge there is a problem, but they're kind of late in addressing it. And then, in the meantime, the virus just spreads, and, in all of these locations, the spread's facilitated by a lack of testing, the fact that it can be spread by people that are asymptomatic. And so you need the testing to figure out who's actually got the virus. Without the testing, you know, people don't know they're, even the ones that are infected don't know they're infected.
No, here,
and
here's
they
a,
can still here's transmit.
Here's a quickie. Half a dozen meat processing plants have now shut down. It's not just Northfield, because of coronavirus. This out of Sioux Falls, Kululi Amosa. I don't know what that is. Maybe Asian, South Pacific Islander. I don't know. Kululi Amosa's husband earned $17.70 an hour at a South Dakota pork plant, doing a job so physically demanding it can only be performed in 30-minute increments. After each shift last week, he left exhausted as usual, but he didn't want to go home. He was scared he would infect his pregnant wife with coronavirus, so much so that when he pulled into the parking lot of their apartment building, he would call Amosa to tell her he wasn't coming inside. When he eventually did, he would sleep separately from her in their two-bedroom apartment. And he said, "I'm really scared and really worried." And it was no abstract. The Smithfield plants, the locker rooms, were so tightly packed, Amosa's husband told her he sometimes had to push his way through a crowd of workers. So good luck. Coughs echoed through the bathrooms. It was reported that 518 infections have now been registered in employees and another 126 in people connected to them. As Henry said, family members and friends outside the business. Go ahead.
Yeah. So, I mean, that story keeps getting repeated over and over again. So, I mean, you got the story of the virus spreading from one processing plant to another. It's in pork plants, it's in beef plants. I think it might even be in some chicken plants. And
it was in one, yes.
They just tend to spread because they're in that area, and you know, it can go from, like I say, one employee might have connections to more than one plant, or, you know, they might be close enough to you know, like Sioux Falls might, you know, it's got a couple there, and other people might live close enough to go into Sioux Falls to shop or whatever, and then get infected because other store owners get infected by the employees of the plant. And so it just kind of spreads all around that way, and the numbers start to go up. And that's the reason these numbers are increasing. It's not just the big cities. It's now these much smaller communities that this county, that county, that hadn't really reported any, all of a sudden they're reporting 50, 100 cases, 1,000 cases over time. And then those numbers just start to add up. And so now it's at those higher levels. And then as far as, I mean, these employees are essential employees, so they're going to work even in states where there's a shutdown. But the idea that if they start to reduce the restrictions and there's more movement, then these places are going to spread it in their community or an adjacent community. And so the idea that, I mean, the whole concept is that this initial lockdown is to get the virus under control and the levels go down low enough that you can start doing contact tracing again and monitoring mm-hmm. it. The problem mm-hmm. is, it's not clear that, well, it's obviously not the governors aren't going to wait for it to get down to this low level. There's already been announcements of, Georgia is the one that kind of stands out. It's got the most press where they're opening up, the nail salons and massage parlors and, tattoo places and bowling alleys and, you know, all of these, not so much the bowling alley, but all the other ones, there's, you know, no social distancing in those types of facilities. And gyms are trying to spread the machines out, and you know, you have to use every other machine or something. So
I've never understood that, Henry. Gyms, I can't even believe how full of all sorts of bacteria and virus they must be. Any of those gyms.
Right.
People are sweating, shedding, touching. Like, that's crazy.
Well, they do some wiping down of them, but essentially, you know, they've been closed. Now they're opening them up. And it's just, movie theaters. I mean, the issue is going to be that most of these, it isn't going to matter if they're open or not. People just aren't going to go there when they know that there's virus all over the place. And it's not, I mean, they'll you know, what, Netflix or something. They're not going to go to the movie
theater.
Hey,
that happened
right
in Wuhan.
Now.
You know that. They opened all sorts of businesses in Wuhan. And guess what? Nobody
People
came.
People didn't go. Right.
Nope.
Well, the same thing's going to happen here. And it's like they've got to get to some level and some confidence that you know, it's worth the extra risk. And a lot of these, it just isn't going to qualify. You know, you might get a few people that go there just because they haven't been able to, but in the past, you know, in the recent past, but it's not going to be that, lucrative. I mean, it's a risk reward type of thing. they're going to open it. They're not going to have that much business. They're going to destroy confidence that the politicians have any idea what they're doing. And the people are just going to stay away from these higher risk type things. And
who's going to go into a restaurant with 40 or 50 people in a dining room and sit literally, a footer? They'll move the tables apart, but it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Who's going to want to do that?
Well,
people are traumatized. They're afraid.
And as soon as they say, well, we'll give it a try, and they hear somebody starting to cough, They're going to say, well, this wasn't that good an idea. We're not going to do this anymore. And it's just stupid. But the reason I'm saying I've got concerns is, you know, you can go one level a little bit further that people think, well, I can go to the beach because we can kind of spread out there. And then a bunch of people think they can go to the beach and spread out. And pretty soon they're not that spread out. And, and then you just start having incidents. I mean, they had the voting in, where was it, Wisconsin or wherever they had.
Wisconsin.
They've got voters and registrars who were, you know, basically signing you in that now have symptoms. I mean, they ended up getting COVID because they decided to vote. And it was, and they were waiting in lines for a long time. You know, it was very bad conditions, even though they were
this
so
is the most volatile virus I've ever heard of. Now, in your professional career, which blows mine to pieces, I have no background like you do. Have you ever seen a virus this volatile, this infectious before?
I mean, that's what the problem is. The problem, and that's why I'm saying that these things are really long shots. The idea that you can control a virus that is this infectious and has this many different ways to infect. You know, the fact that you don't have to have symptoms. There's some evidence that says you shed quite a bit of virus before you develop symptoms.
Uh-huh.
And those are just bad conditions for controlling it. And then exactly how widespread it is still up in the air. I mean, they're starting to do antibody tests, although it's not clear how accurate all these tests are. And even just doing random testing with PCR says that in certain areas, high percentage of the population has already been infected. And so, if you start figuring out how many people have been infected, you realize that, you know, it's 5%, 10% of the population. And then you plug that in a city, how many people would be infected in that particular city, you realize that you're not going to be able to do contact tracing. I mean, you're literally going to be tracing, you know, hundreds of thousands or millions of people. And with that many people that have been infected, under lockdown conditions, that it kind of just tells you how widespread the virus is and how easily it spreads. And then all these reports that are coming out are all of these different problems that the patients are having. That you know, it's interfering with clotting, it's going to different organs, it's causing problems with, you know, oxygen transfer. So it's not really the pneumonia. It's really just the ability to transfer the oxygen. And these things kind of develop and they, you know, just get to a critical level. I mean, they don't show up that much in x-rays and pneumonia doesn't look that bad, but they still have low levels of oxygen because they're not really transferring the oxygen that well. And all of a sudden they kind of get to this really low level and then they run into all of these problems that develop very, very quickly, and it's hard to get the patients under control. And so they just create all kinds of problems in the hospitals and even places like New York, where they kind of seem to be on a downward slope. Instead of getting 3,000 people being identified each day in the state, it's half that number, but it's still 13, 14, 1,500 people per day are new cases, and they still have critical patients that are still in the ICU. They haven't all died off or been discharged. And so they're still relatively full, even though they're not at this critical level where they have no beds available. They've got some beds available, and it's not as crazy with 3,000 new people being identified are being admitted in a day. But it's still at a high enough level that if you only get another surge, you're going to be back to where you were a month ago. You're going to have all these people coming in and not being able to handle them, and people just dying from heart attacks. And then they apparently are dying from a whole series of things. I think the New York Times had an article. I got to take a look at it. I just saw a couple of representations. But they were just plotting the number of deaths daily in a given city. And they did it against historic norms. And they got, you know, the historic norms. So it's a nice, smooth curve that goes along at a given rate. It's going up or down a little bit depending upon the season. And then this year you just see this great big surge that all of a sudden it just jumps up above that seasonal background. And, those are, you know, obviously COVID cases. And so you compare how many people are represented by that increase in curve, and you realize that they're really only getting a small percentage of the positives, even as far as deaths are concerned. So you have the death rate goes up, and it's not reflected in the number of confirmed cases that are confirmed deaths that are recorded. So there's all these additional deaths that have been happening all along, and you can see it if you compare it to historic levels. Now it's the same thing with the emergency calls in New York that you know they're getting 200 or something on a daily basis.
Are they still getting a lot of heart attacks now showing up still much above norm?
I think it's above norm. It's not as high as it was like 3 or 4 weeks ago, but it's still exceeding historic levels. So that they are still getting people that are dying at home, and I think they're supposed to do adjustments for that. I don't think they've really done that yet. They did adjustments for the ones that had COVID on the death certificate that they didn't that they didn't test, and so they've added those. They were improbable. So some of the states, they were all supposed to do that. I don't know. Sometimes it's hard to tell from their data. I mean, they have one that says total deaths, or it just says deaths, and then it says probable deaths, and it's a little bit unclear whether the probable is there to show you how many of the total deaths are probable, or whether the probable are there and you're supposed to add those two together to get the actual number. And I don't know the states are that consistent. You know, some of them present the data one way and some present the other way. But they do have those. But I don't think they've really done the probable deaths based upon deaths above historic levels. And it's also clear that they really haven't done complete testing. I mean, it's like I said, Pennsylvania went up 360 deaths today, and I kind of looked at Western Pennsylvania to get an idea where they were, and some of them are nursing homes, but some of the nursing homes that I know have literally like 700 potential cases, and they're listing how many they've tested, and they haven't really tested that many more. So they still have facilities where they've identified a number of positives who are asymptomatic, and it's not clear that they're doing any more testing. They've only tested a subset, and they've identified, you know, 50, 60 cases, but you know, all of the patients and another, I don't know, 30, 40 of the staff. So they've got almost 100 identified, but there are others that are there. And some of the ones that are identified are said to be asymptomatic. And, it's not clear that they've gotten aggressive, and they said, well, we're going to go ahead and test everybody. And there's another one in the adjacent county, in Beaver County, and it was the same thing. The number of deaths went up there. They used to have 10, and now it's up to 30 or something. But there was supposed to be 700 in that facility, and they're not listing that many cases for Beaver County. They list only three institutions, so this big one's one of the three, and they don't really have that many. So it's not like they know there's a problem, and they didn't test them last week, but they tested them this week, and that's part of the reason there was this big jump in cases. It looks like the jump in cases are ones that have already been identified,
yeah. Okay.
And they're not doing more testing.
Couple of other things here. The virus is said now to have been identified to have mutated to over 30 different strains. Now, it's difficult for people to understand that. They'll think, oh, 30 different fatal strains. Not necessarily. They all have their different characteristics. Can you explain a little bit more about that, please?
Right. Well, here's how they divide them up. I mean, there's basically, right now, there's three major lineages, and these lineages are based on changes that happened fairly early on. So there's the one that I've referred to as the ORF8 lineage, mm-hmm. and then there's the one I've called the Italian lineage, and then there's one other one that it actually also was in Italy also, but it then went to Iran. So you can kind of think of it that way. So one went to Iran, one went to Italy, and one went to, like, Seattle, or it actually went to several places in the U.S. And then each of these lineages still have new changes. You know, they have another one or two positions to change. And because of the number of sequences now, just to give you an idea, there are 10,000, over 10,000 now, sequences of this virus that are now public. So 10,000 sequences have been made public, you know, in like 3 months. And frankly, most of those sequences have happened in the last 1 month, or at least they've been released in the last 1 month. So a week ago, there were 5,000. Maybe it's 2 weeks ago, there were 5,000. Now there's 10,000. And, you know, a month ago, there might have been 1,000 or 2,000. So a lot of these sequences have come on board recently. And as a result, you can kind of make this phylogenetic tree where, well, you've got the Italian strain, and that's defined by like four changes. And then, you know, half of those end up with one additional change. So that kind of starts a new branch. It's got the original four plus this one. And then they tack on a couple more. And so this happens. You know, you can see it happening because of the number of sequences that are released. And so you can get these different variations, these different branches on the tree that have one additional change, and then they have another one and another one. So now it's been around long enough that some of these recent ones might, instead of just having two or three changes from the original, they've got, you know, six or seven changes now. And they can trace those. And so those are, you've got different branches off of these major lineages. So they have the same, for the Italian one, there's like four changes. They've got those same four changes, but then some have a fifth one, and then a sixth and a seventh, and the other ones have the fifth one, but they don't have the sixth or seventh, or they got the fifth one plus a couple other ones. They form another branch. And so that's what they're talking about with these different branches. And so these are changes, and they don't really know how significant they are. They just know that you can see
Got it.
A went to B, went to C.
Well, okay.
And you can distinguish it and you can describe it. So, I mean, it's specific changes at specific positions. So everybody that looks at the sequence agrees it's not something you have to interpret. You know, that this one's got six and this one's got five. Uh-huh. I mean, everybody agrees that this one falls on this branch and this one falls on the other branch. But how significant those other changes are is
got
to
it.
Be determined.
CDC is now warning, Redfield, I guess his name is, the CDC director, is warning of a worse second wave in the fall. Now, that would suggest what? Does that suggest that the Italian strain will get to be more sophisticated or another strain might walk in that's deadly and we don't know?
Right. There's two different, there's really three different ways it can be worse in the fall. And it's not clear exactly which. I think the one he was referring to was simply the fact that in the fall, that will be a new flu season.
That's right.
And he's essentially saying that it's going to be bad because you're going to have some people that have the flu and you have other people that have this virus and that, they both end up developing pneumonia, both types of patients.
Could be a catastrophe if you get both.
It's not that you're going to get both. It's that the hospital's going to get both. So they're essentially saying that instead of like now, where most of the activity happened, I mean, they showed that one graph of the influenza-like illness. And there were three peaks on it. So there was one peak that was influenza B, and then it started to go down, and then A came and made another peak, and then it started to go down, and then COVID came and made another peak. And the point was that the COVID kind of came after A and B were starting to fade.
They were in their decline.
And so it happened more towards the end of the flu season. And what he's saying is if the virus hangs around and if it starts to increase in the flu season, then you're going to have both types of patients, all of which need hospital beds. And on a bad flu season, you can kind of be stretching the medical.
That raises the issue of should hospitals go back to elective procedures now in the summer when they have a chance, or should they continue to be prepared? Redfield said we're going to have the flu epidemic and the coronavirus epidemic at the same time, predicting a dual assault on the healthcare system and hospitals.
Right. And so here's some of the things that are the same and are different. With swine flu, what happened with swine flu is somewhat analogous, but it didn't create that big of a problem because it was competing with the flu. And as a result, what happened in 2009 in the spring, kind of like what's happened with COVID, is that the swine flu kept on going beyond the end of the flu season. So March and April, especially April and May, by then, the only flu virus that was circulating was swine flu. A and B were essentially gone. And then swine kind of was around over the summer, but at lower levels. And then when it picked up in the fall, it basically outcompeted the other two. And part of that might be not just because of antibodies, but it might even be for things like interferon. There's different things you do that are antiviral. And if the swine flu elicits this antiviral that may block the ability of another flu to kind of pop up. So, I mean, that could happen with this also. But so what happened with flu, the only thing that was circulating in the fall was swine flu. The seasonal H1N1 wasn't circulating. H3N2 wasn't circulating, and even influenza B wasn't circulating. So it was somewhat controlled because the only thing that was circulating was swine flu. And it started early. Now, if you recall, it started really taking off when school started in the South, which is like the beginning of August.
Right.
And so the flu season didn't really start in like November, December, like it usually does. It was going full speed by beginning of September, because that's when the rest, cooler climate started, school season. And then it got much worse, at least in Pittsburgh for sure, when, in like October kind of really started to take off where everybody was getting fevers and being sent home from school, and there was a lot of absenteeism. But the point is that in that case, it kind of replaced the flu. They weren't really both competing, that it was just the swine flu. But it did come early in the season, and it did last, and it started to fade by the time the vaccine came around in December. It was already on the downturn. So it had already peaked in like October is when it peaked. And it was on the downturn, and then the vaccine became available like in December. But the point is that, in that case, it was just the swine flu, but it was somewhat unusual that it lasted longer in the spring and it started earlier in the fall. And COVID may do exactly the same thing, because it certainly is lasting longer in the spring. So, I mean, that peak that was on that ILI came after the other two. So it basically peaked like a month ago or so. And A and B were pretty much done. And so it could be that there won't be that much flu next season and that it won't be quite that bad, or it could be that this is a totally different virus.
We have a bad flu season.
It's a cold virus. And so you could have them both. So that's one way it could be worse. Now, the other way it can be worse is that, a fairly good percentage of the population has been affected, not like 30, 40, 50%, but 5 or 10%. And so if a virus, you have all these different strains that you just mentioned, you got 30 different, well, they're not really all lineages. You got kind of three lineages and then 10 different variations of each. Mm-hmm. And if one of those changes gives it an advantage, so that people that were infected by the original Wuhan strain or one of the earlier versions and got infected, in February or March or so, and have some immunity, if one of these changes comes along and can evade that immunity, then it would have an advantage against the versions that were still susceptible to that immunity. And sometimes that advantage can lead to that strain being dominant. And then in the fall, it could be that one of these 30 different versions has become more and more dominant because it can infect these people that were infected in the spring, and therefore it could also become more virulent. And it can become more virulent just because it's a higher viral load. Some people had a higher viral load and they passed it along, and those people started with a higher viral load, so they got up to a higher level and they passed it on. And so you kind of got the same sequence, but you got more of it. And then they end up with a more severe disease, which is kind of what happened with the swine flu. It's kind of like people got infected at the beginning of the school season in September, and they had a cough, but they weren't really that sick. And then it circulated enough in the schools, and you started getting people that had higher levels. And all of a sudden, by October, it was kind of the same virus, but there was just more of it that you got infected with, and you ended up having more severe symptoms. And so that could happen in the fall. That in the spring, it can affect anybody because nobody's got any immunity. And so you have all these kind of weaker versions that, you know, if there was a little bit of immunity, they would be asymptomatic.
Yeah, we got to jump to the third. We got to jump to the third possibility real quick.
And
those were two.
Well, the third possibility is that, I guess.
Well, we can do that tomorrow night. Well, we're running out of time here. So, but basically, we're at a situation now where Trump is going to roll the dice. A lot of people are not going to be wearing masks and keeping distance. And this virus is, in all likelihood, going to take off again. And that's going to set everything back.
Well, that's the reason it's so dangerous, is because this virtually ensures that the virus isn't going anywhere. It's not like it's going to go down to a very low level and then it's got to pick up steam and get going again. It's going to hang around, and it's going to do just like swine flu. It was around in summer camps, and it wasn't that well publicized, but it was there, and it started up August 1st with school. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what the story is going to be with school. You know, if people think it's over, they're going to say, well, let's just get back to normal. We got football coming. We got high school sports. We got college sports. And what's the problem? And, it could exacerbate things pretty dramatically. So,
All right. Well, we'll watch it. Thank you, Henry. Talk to you tomorrow night as we continue to walk through this pandemic. Crazy times. All right. Thanks much. Good job.
Great stuff. Okay. Take care.
Okay. Good night. Dr. Henry Nyman, and thank you for being here. We'll be back tomorrow night. Let's see. William Gein will be here. Joel Skousen will be here tomorrow night, and Henry, and yours truly, and I hope all of you. Talk to you tomorrow.